Welcome to this, the Monday edition of Closer Look. I'm Jim Burris.
And I'm Rose Scott. We begin with this. After 30 years of operating several golf courses in the Atlanta area, American Golf will no longer operate North Fulton, Bobby Jones, Browns Mill, Alfred Tupp Homes, or Candler Park Golf Courses. In an email sent to its patrons and guests over the weekend, American Golf stated, quote, it has been our sincere hope to come to an arrangement with the City of Atlanta, which would permit American Golf to continue operating these courses as we've done for the past 30 years. Goes on to say, unfortunately, despite the efforts of everyone involved, we were not able to reach such an agreement. As a result, American Golf will no longer lease or operate any of the above courses as of November 1st, 2016.
And from American Golf, Paul Ballum, VP of Business Development for American Golf, told WABE News, "We're very proud to have partnered with the City of Atlanta for more than 30 years and have been pleased to serve Atlanta's golfing public. We will be contacting our patrons directly this week regarding how they can use their American Golf benefits, such as Players Club memberships and Atlanta Golf Passes, at our other golf courses in the greater Atlanta area. At this time, we have no information regarding the city's plans for the operation of the five municipal golf courses after October 31st. This summer, the Atlanta City Council voted to give the Bobby Jones Golf Course to the state. It was part of a deal in accordance with the sale of Underground Atlanta to a private developer."
And speaking of the City of Atlanta, we did reach out to them. In a statement, a city spokesperson told Closer Look, quote, "We will circle back shortly." Now, Jim, there's a lot of history connected to these courses, as you know, and especially Tupp Homes Golf Course. It was over 60 years ago a Supreme Court decision desegregated America's public golf courses. That lawsuit was initiated in 1953 by Alfred Tupp Homes. He and his family were turned away from the Bobby Jones course, one of seven public golf courses in Atlanta at the time, because they were black. It reached the Supreme Court 2 years later, and this is recognized as the first desegregation lawsuit in Atlanta, and obviously some national implications as well. Our own Tisneen Shama will have more on this during All Things Considered. This is Closer Look. According to the latest poll by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Secretary Hillary Clinton trails Donald Trump in Georgia, but only by a slight margin. Now, the poll released last Friday shows Trump ahead about 44 percentage points to Clinton's 42. Libertarian Gary Johnson is about right at 9%, and another 4% are undecided. Now, electing the next president is just one of several choices on the ballot. There are four statewide constitutional amendments proposed as well. This week on Closer Look, we'll review all of them. Today, we start with Amendment 2, which, according to the ballot language, quote, authorizes penalties for sexual exploitation and assessments on adult entertainment to fund child victim services. This is called the Safe Harbor Amendment, and there are opposable sides to this ballot. Well, joining Closer Look on the line is Atlanta-based attorney Alan Begner, who's represented adult entertainment businesses. And in our studio, Kirsten Widener, longtime child advocate and attorney and a policy consultant. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's begin here. There are two components to this amendment. Let's start with the penalties for criminal cases, Ms. Widener. Explain that portion of the amendment.
So basically right now, the judges have an option to give a fine to people convicted of trafficking. That's going to be people who have pimped children or other victims of human trafficking or people who have bought sexual services from a trafficking victim. This will require a fine of $2,500 for anyone with such a conviction and earmark that money for services for victims of exploitation, particularly those under 18.
So the resources and services for victims based on those who were convicted of crimes basically related to trafficking or sexual abuse of minors in a commercial settings, but pretty much what you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, Attorney Begner, before we get to the fees for adult businesses, what are your thoughts on that particular portion of the amendment?
Well, insofar as people who are convicted of pimping child prostitutes are being fined or convicted, we support that.
And the amendment also calls for, a quote, an assessment on adult entertainment businesses. It's going to be a $5,000 annual fee on strip clubs and other adult businesses. Mr. Begner, what's the problem with this part of the amendment as you see it?
Well, there's lots of problems. It's, excuse me, it's 5% or 1% of gross. So the amount of the taxes will be in the neighborhood of $15,000 to $50,000 or $60,000 a year. But the problem is that adult entertainment establishments in Atlanta and throughout Georgia do not contribute to child prostitution. The dancers who dance at adult clubs, almost without exception, have to be permitted by the local police departments, prove their age, prove they have no criminal record in the near past, and so they otherwise can't dance in adult clubs. And the customers are all 21 or over, so there's no children in the crowd at all. And so to blame adult entertainment establishments for being a cause of child prostitution is unsupported by any neutral evidence. And it would also have the effect of demonizing clubs. And if that happens, all kinds of bad things otherwise can happen in the future.
And explain for me what you mean by other things could happen in the future.
Well, then you create actual secondary effects that don't exist, for which governments could raise the taxes even more. They could try to put clubs out of business entirely when a certain political group comes in as county commission or city. And so when you're said to be a cause of child prostitution, lots of bad possible things in the future can happen.
Ms. Wider, let me get your thoughts on this, because you have been a longtime advocate as it relates to policy and child law. Is there data to suggest there is a connection between adult entertainment businesses and the sexual exploitation of children?
There is. In 2005, the Atlanta Mayor's Office produced a report called Hidden in Plain View. And in that report, they did a analysis of all arrests of children for prostitution-related activities and found a really close connection between where those arrests were happening and where the clubs are located. And so the analysis led to the conclusion that it's a secondary effect of having an adult entertainment establishment that other activities that are illegal will congregate around those otherwise legal businesses. And to Mr. Begner's point, it isn't so much that the clubs are directly promoting it. The idea is not that the clubs are to blame. It's simply that they draw these other types of activity to the areas in which they operate. And so it's a secondary effect. And our courts have long allowed legislatures and city councils to regulate the negative secondary effects of adult entertainment.
Someone listening may say, well, Ms. Widener, you just said 2005. This is 2016. Are you telling me then that this has gotten worse? Is that data still accurate that even in 2016, there's still this connection between these type of establishments? And we're talking about strip clubs, but the language says strip clubs and adult entertainment businesses. So be a little bit more, you know, let's clarify. We're talking about shops where people can buy just adult-natured items?
So the definition of adult entertainment establishment in the law has two prongs. The first is where the entertainment consists of nude or semi-nude performances, modeling of lingerie, or paid personal contact with a person. The second prong is that establishment also has to serve alcohol. So if you have a club that doesn't serve alcohol, they would not be subject to this restriction. The idea is that the combination of drinking with the stimulation provided by the entertainment is part of what leads to the negative secondary effects.
Do you know of any business that provides those services to their clients that does not sell alcohol?
I don't personally have a lot of knowledge about that.
Fair enough. Attorney Begner,
yes.
your response to what you just heard.
So now what I hear is that it's not the clubs themselves that cause the problem inside, but that prostitutes may hang around outside or near the clubs. We, of course, clear our parking lot. We police parking lots and clear our parking lots at the end of the night so that dancers may leave without being followed. But when you start saying that just because they're nearby, arrest reports may use the nearest available address, for instance, when it has nothing to do with that address. then you're expanding the question even more. Without any doubt, prostitution comes from, and child prostitution, runaways from home, internet chat rooms, pimps on the street. But they surround places like hotels. If you look at the arrest reports, you will find that probably McDonald's has the most prostitution arrests near its addresses and many other mainstream businesses. So you have to look at just why an arrest made near a club is attributable to the club. And again, we don't think the state, who has the burden of proving it, can prove that.
Have you researched that? Have you looked at arrest reports, and can you make that conclusion?
Well, we did in Fulton County in the early, in around 2000, 2001, when six Fulton County clubs defended, and I was part of it, a ban on new dancing and alcohol clubs, and they did an official study of secondary effects measuring six Fulton County adult clubs with six regular nightclubs in Fulton County without nude and alcohol, and that official report found half as much crime at adult clubs as similarly situated regular clubs. It's a part of a case called Flanagan's 1 versus Fulton County, and that report has made its way into 30 or 40 Supreme Courts throughout the country and has twice been mentioned by Justice Souter in the U.S. Supreme Court as not supporting the proposition that new dance clubs and alcohol cause the secondary effects suggested by those who say so.
If you're just joining us, our conversation is about Amendment 2, that according to that ballot language authorizes penalties for sexual exploitation and assessments on adult entertainment to fund child victim services. Our guests are Kirsten Widener, longtime child advocate attorney and policy consultant, and Atlanta-based attorney Alan Begner, who represents many adult entertainment businesses. Ms. Widener, I want to get your thoughts on what Attorney Begner said about McDonald's and that being a business that might harbor more of that type of activity than a strip club.
Well, you know, the Georgia General Assembly held hours and hours and hours of hearings to try and get at the root of the problem of child sex trafficking in Georgia. And in all of that testimony, we heard nothing about these other legitimate businesses. What we did hear was from multiple victims and advocates who work with victims about the experiences of their clients or their themselves in, around, and out of strip clubs. And so the testimony that the General Assembly received was pretty consistent, and it was over a number of years. We had our first study committee hearing on this run by Senator Unterman back in 2007, and we've had a series of them ever since, and none of these other businesses have come up. So when we talk to the survivors, what we're hearing is a specific nexus with the adult entertainment industry that we're not hearing with other businesses.
And this money would go to organizations that work primarily with victims who they want to give services to, correct?
That's correct. We have, there's such a complex trauma that happens to somebody who is sexually exploited, particularly when that happens when they're under the age of 18. They need a lifetime of services, and that's a very expensive proposition to fund. And so this is a critical resource to help provide those necessary services to those kids.
Do you know if any other states, if they have some legislation and policy set up like this?
So specifically like the safe harbor provision, not quite. But there are a couple of other states that have put assessments on their adult entertainment industries to provide related services. And both of the states that I'm familiar with where that's been challenged in court, the assessment has been upheld by the state Supreme Court. So in Utah, an assessment is made to fund services for sex offenders, treatment services for sex offenders. The Utah Supreme Court upheld that assessment. Additionally, Texas has an assessment that goes to sexual assault programs, and that has also been upheld by the Texas Supreme Court.
Alan Begner, I want to ask you about the language of this constitutional amendment. Do you think that it is leading and that it may, just by the way it's worded, I mean, it either passes or fails?
Well, the wording of constitutional amendments is an issue, a big issue for all Georgians, because it almost never reflects the truth of the amendment. And you can't tell by the small language that you see on the ballot what it really means. But you know what? We, as an industry, support the program. That is the rehabilitation of child prostitution. We think it's a worthy program. If asked, I bet you we would give charitable contributions to it. But the question to me is, and to all of us who have an interest in this side of the case, is nude dancing is protected speech under the First Amendment and the Georgia Constitution's First Amendment, and it cannot be taxed. The way that the amendment tries to get around it is to assert that because we cause the child prostitution to occur, that we can be held accountable. We'll see whether or not the state can prove that when the time comes. I think our industry is just waiting for the ballot to be voted on. Whenever you have an amendment that doesn't cost money from the taxpayers, the chances of it passing are better. And so I wouldn't be surprised if it does.
And Ms. Widener, I noticed that you were nodding your head in agreement with Alan Begner with his answer. Do you also agree that the language as it is on the ballot probably will sway voters one way?
I agree with Mr. Begner that our state's presentation of the contents of constitutional amendments is not always what as clear and transparent as we would hope it would be. I actually think the ballot language for Amendment 2 is one of the more clearly written and less misleading of the four that are going to be on the ballot. But certainly, I think we could do a better service to our citizens if we were clearer about the contents.
Attorney Begner, this is called an assessment. Some may say it's actually a fine or a fee. Does that language, is that problematic for you?
Well, you can call an assessment assessment, but it's still a tax. And the notion that you can change the prior restraint laws on First Amendment speech by calling it assessment, I think, has been found against the states, either in Texas or Utah, found that it was a tax, not an assessment. But I want to say one other thing. The GBI has done its own investigation and has found little or no correlation between child prostitution and adult clubs. And I went to a three-hour presentation by Homeland Security to have them teach me and others. In fact, many people in the adult industry went to learn more. And I, although they would say there have been at least one or two cases of children dancing in clubs, they do not also, I believe, find that such a correlation exists. So the battle will be over anecdotal ideas, I think, for which require real evidence, and we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Ms. Widener?
I just want to quickly address the idea that this is a prior restraint. Prior restraint requires that the restraint is prior, that it happens before the expressive activity occurs. In this case, we have an assessment on fees earned in the prior year. So it's definitely after, and then the standard is different. Consistently, the courts have upheld legislation and restrictions that deal with the secondary effects of adult entertainment. And the same has happened in the other two states that I mentioned. Those were dealt with as secondary effects legislation, and those were upheld by their state Supreme Courts. And I'm confident that this will survive a similar challenge.
So, Mr. Begner, if approved by voters, you're saying there will be a next legal step for your clients?
I think the industry has just, they've just decided to wait to see if the amendment passes. There also is, by the way, some more problematic parts of it by giving Georgia Revenue, for example, the right to create rules and regulations to collect the money, which they don't exist yet, and this overwhelming power to audit gross receipts to determine that a club might be falsely reporting the amount of gross receipts they've made. These rules and regulations also have to be looked at and challenged, and they're not yet in existence. Georgia Revenue is waiting to see if it passes, too. So I think we're all in the same boat. If it passes, then Georgia Revenue's got to create regulations, and then I believe clubs will challenge it, if for no other reason than because they just don't want to be said to be causing it, even if they can afford the assessments.
at the end of the day, we're still left with a serious problem. What suggestions do you all have, you know, if the vote doesn't go your way, to still address this and get to a solution? Ms. Widener, we'll start with you.
Well, the advocates would certainly welcome the donation Mr. Begman suggested from the industry. But additionally, we hope that we'll continue to put pressure on our state elected officials. They've been very supportive of these victims in the past. They would obviously prefer to have an additional stream of revenue to help pay for these important services. But if that doesn't happen, we obviously would like to see their continued support for these services.
Alan Begner.
You know, it's interesting. I think the main reason for the amendment was a good one. That is to create a funding mechanism to ensure that whatever money comes in goes for the purpose sought instead of taken by the legislature and spent on any number of other things. I think that if it passes, then the clubs will comply. All together try to fight child prostitution, because the clubs are not in that business at all. And so I think that if we lose, we'll continue to try to help.
We've been speaking with Alan Begner, an Atlanta-based attorney, and also Kirsten Widener. We've been talking about Amendment 2. Voters head to the polls on Tuesday, November 8th. Thank you both for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Rose.
If Jonas Salk was alive, he'd be 102 this week. You might recognize the name as the person who led the team to develop a vaccine against, get this, poliomyelitis, or as we plain folks say, polio. Crippling and potentially fatal, the condition paralyzed hundreds of thousands of children each year. Now, an effective vaccine came on the market in 1955, and within 2 years, incidence of polio in the U.S. fell by 90%.
Today, just Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria have never stopped polio transmission. Only those three countries. Globally, just 74 cases were reported last year. But still, the call to eradicate the virus remains strong. Especially on this day, it's World Polio Day. Carol Pandak is director of the Polio Plus program at Rotary International, and she's in Atlanta because this year the CDC is playing host to the world event. And on her way over to the campus this morning, she stopped in the Closer Look studio for a chat. Welcome to the Closer Look studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I mentioned 1955, and within a relatively short period, polio kind of went from one of the most feared public health concerns around to one that was widely seen as controllable. When did this worldwide eradication become a global unified goal, though?
You know, it's interesting. The World Health Assembly in 1988 adopted the resolution to eradicate polio that was built on Rotary's early work in the Philippines in 1979 when we held our first polio immunization campaign. We followed that with a large fundraising effort to raise $120 million for polio eradication. And we surprised ourselves, and we raised $247 million. So we presented our case, I'd say, to the World Health Assembly, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and we were really seen as the catalyst, bringing the funds and the volunteer army in order to help immunize children around the world.
Rotary International is a service organization. So what prompted Rotary in kind of the mid-80s to really pick this up as a cause system organization-wide?
Yeah, the organization was looking for something to do in recognition of its 75th anniversary. And also smallpox was had been eradicated in the late 70s. And so the president at the time asked, happened to be on an airplane with one of our Rotary leaders, and asked, you know, if you would do something next, what would it be? And he suggested polio, I think because it's a vaccine-preventable disease. Volunteers can actually administer the oral polio vaccine. And we had an army of Rotarians around the world who were looking to do something really big.
I mentioned earlier only Afghanistan and Pakistan have never stopped polio, you know, altogether. What's prevented these two countries specifically from achieving really what the rest of the world has?
Yeah. So, and actually, it's now Pakistan, Afghanistan, and just recently, Nigeria has been put back on the list of polio endemic countries because of recent cases that have been found, and it suggests that that virus has been circulating for several years. So we really have three countries that have never stopped. And I think it's not surprising those countries still have polio. There is conflict in the countries, geographically remote populations, and insufficient hygiene. So that really allows the virus to circulate in communities.
There were just 74 cases confirmed last year, 2015. Why then, with so few cases, is polio really considered a global health threat?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And so far this year, there's only 27 cases. But as long as polio exists anywhere, it's a threat to children everywhere. And here in the United States, and certainly in many countries around the world, governments continue to immunize their children, governments and parents continue to immunize their children against polio because the virus can travel. It knows no borders. So we like to say it's a plane ride away.
If the widespread vaccination efforts weren't as successful or didn't permeate like they actually do, what might the polio picture look like going forward?
Right. So when the World Health Assembly adopted the resolution to eradicate polio, there were some 350,000 cases every year. Analysts say that within the next 10 years, if we don't continue on the road to eradication, there could be up to 200,000 cases every year within the next 10 years.
Do you think that may be a barrier to people's conception of how big a threat polio really is? I mean, we talk about 74 cases. You mentioned the word 200,000 within 10 years. It's hard to wrap your head around that.
One of my colleagues at the Smithsonian describes polio as the AIDS of its day, right? People were terrified. You know, parents were terrified. And if you can't see it, you know, you start to forget what it looks like. And so in countries where it hasn't been eradicated and you can see the cases of polio, it's just, you know, children crawling on the ground, a lifelong difficulties, you can't work, et cetera. So it is in the face of a waning disease. It's really important to try to keep it high on the political and public agenda.
Some might also ask, because there are so few cases now, and it is relatively contained, why spend so much money on eradicating it?
Yeah. As I said, you know, the cost is really that we're continuing to immunize hundreds of millions of children. The number of cases will come back. But there's also been another analysis that says that by eradicating polio, you'll save between $40 and $50 billion between the 1988 when it was started and 2035. People are able to work, you don't have to care for them. And so it's really a good investment, even if it seems that the cost is high. The long-term outcomes are much better.
Like polio, smallpox, which you mentioned a moment ago, was a contagious and disfiguring virus that spread relatively easy from person to person. I say was because smallpox was eliminated, eradicated globally officially in 1980, yet we're still discussing ways to eradicate polio. So why was it possible to stop one virus and not this other?
For the smallpox virus, it was very clear in a community who had smallpox, so you could tell very clearly where the issues were. For polio, not every person who contracts polio is actually paralyzed by the virus. So 1 in 200 actually show the symptoms, and so it can be circulating quietly and unknown in a community. So sometimes it's harder to identify, and it's taking a little bit longer to root out every last case.
Looking ahead, what still needs to be done to eradicate polio?
To eradicate polio, we still need to immunize hundreds of millions of children through the Global Polio Eradication Initiative. We need to increase our surveillance activities. So there are surveillance medical officers that actually go out into communities and actually look for children who have symptoms of the virus. And we're also increasing and intensifying the environmental surveillance, testing sewage samples to see if the virus is circulating in the water, because it can live in water for a short period of time. But we also have to contain the virus. There's universities and laboratories around the world that have samples of the virus, because that's how you test for polio and stool samples. So you have to ensure that those samples are properly contained, and there's a whole program of work for that. But I would say, too, the activities that we're doing, the polio immunization activities, have to be of the highest quality. And that's a real focus of the program right now, too.
Is that an ever-evolving process, or is it pretty much the same today as it was, say, 5-10 years ago?
It is an evolving process. I think you learn. There are innovations. Now we go house to house. We used to have fixed posts, so you knock on a door. How many children are there? You used to maybe hire health workers on a short-term basis. Now we hire them on a longer-term basis so that they're in the communities talking about broader messages than just polio, and really getting to know the families, and then the families in turn trust them. So there have been innovations along the way. It's a very intense process, going door to door. And if you think of hundreds of millions of children that need to be immunized, how many people and the dedication it takes to do that in some of the most difficult circumstances for it.
And as we close here, again, tell us why that kind of public recognition is so essential.
You know, it's important because the public plays an important role in engaging with political leaders and the advocacy needed to continue to support polio eradication. When people can see where we are in polio, we would invite them to reach out to their political leaders, congresspeople, and encourages them to continue to support the global polio eradication effort, which they've done for many, many years.
Carol Pandak is director of the Polio Plus program at Rotary International, and she's joined me in studio here to talk about efforts to eradicate the virus on this World Polio Day. Carol, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
And there's a countdown on the website, endpolio.org, and that is for Rotary's 4th annual live-streamed World Polio Day event. And that's going to be broadcast from the CDC, which is hosting this year's event. 4 hours, 21 minutes until that starts. Again, that website, endpolio.org. This is Closer Look on member-supported 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
Electing the next president is just one of several choices on the ballots for Georgia voters. And, of course, some legislative races. Well, we can't think of two better people to talk about this. Our own Dennis O'Hare and our political reporter Johnny Kaufman talk about what the Democrats hope to gain in this year's legislative contest, since they have no hope of taking out of the chamber from the Republicans.
Hey, Johnny.
Hey, Dennis.
Okay, you've been looking at the House and Senate rosters, the Atlanta House and Senate rosters. For Democrats to take control of the legislature, what would they need to do?
Well, Democrats need to flip about 30 seats total, and there's basically no chance they can pull that off. Here's why. So there are very few races in Georgia where a Democrat and a Republican will even be on the ballot. About 15% of the Senate races and only 20% of the House races.
And that's because of the way the legislature, which at the time it happened was dominated by Republicans, that's the way they drew the lines. They draw the lines for the districts.
Exactly. And it looks even less likely Democrats could take over when we consider which of those few races are actually competitive. From what I've heard from sources on both sides, there's really only a handful of competitive Senate and House races, nowhere near enough for the Democrats to take control of either chamber.
All right. So if power doesn't change hands in the legislature, and we have so few competitive races, as you just pointed out, what's at stake here, especially for Democrats who keep saying they want to be the majority again?
It's all about the supermajority. So Republicans are right on the edge of a supermajority in both the House and the Senate. What a supermajority does is it's 120 in the House, 37 in the Senate, and it's needed for constitutional amendments and veto overrides. So when it comes down to issues we're looking at next session, casino gambling, that would take a constitutional amendment. And the Democrats are going to have a big say in that, even if the Republicans have a supermajority. Georgia House Minority Leader Stacey Abrams says more Democrats means more influence over that issue and others, like Medicaid expansion, for example. And Abrams is known for working with Republicans to get some small wins for her party.
We're going to disagree on some issues. We're going to agree on others. And I think the more folks we have at the table, the more we can get, but also the more opportunities we have to really think broadly about what the state should look like.
Besides just influence over issues and debates, there's also a sort of momentum factor here. The more Democrats win, the more likely they hold their seats the next time around, and the party can sort of expand from there.
But there will be some competitive races, even if they're just a few. What are a couple of the ones that you're watching really closely in the Atlanta area?
Yeah, one that's likely to be really competitive is House District 80. That's currently held
by Brookhaven, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. That's currently held by Taylor Bennett, a Democrat. It was a Republican before him. Republican Megan Hansen is really pushing there. And that's one that I think is going to be a toss-up, too.
And there's probably a little money in that one on both sides.
There is. There's definitely money going into that on both sides. And if you look, say, in Henry County, there's a seat there held by Republican Brian Strickland. There's a lot of money going into that race on both sides. And we will see that is one that could kind of go depending on how the presidential election goes, actually.
And you alluded to this just a moment ago. The implication is that Republicans all agree among themselves. And we all know that that's not true, especially in this election year. They have been divided among themselves over their presidential candidate.
Right. It's something, you know, Donald Trump is something that Republicans have been talking about. Here's State Representative Matt Hatchett. He's heads the political committee for the Republicans in the House.
Early on, we met with our members and said, you run your race and let the other races run themselves, but we're staying focused on our people.
Now, Democrats think Trump gives them a really big chance here to make some extra gains this year. Abrams says Trump will push women to vote for Clinton and Democrats down ballot. You know, I have spoken to Republican women who say they won't vote for Trump, but many of them also say they will vote for the Republicans down ballot. So that's something that we're going to be watching closely on election night to see, you know, maybe a county that goes for Clinton still goes for the Republicans down ballot. It's really just hard to say.
And are the Republicans hoping that Johnny Isaacson, who's the next highest candidate on the ballot, the incumbent Republican senator, will kind of act as a firewall? Because with any luck from a Republican point of view, they will have already turned back to their party to vote for him.
Definitely. And, you know, Senator Isaacson, his campaign is really the backbone of the Republican campaign statewide. I think right now there's a lot of money there. He's well liked by most Republicans. And so you're right. I think that having Senator Isaacson on the ballot will likely help some of those down ballot folks.
WABE political reporter Johnny Coffman. Johnny, thanks so much.
Thanks, Dennis.
Voters will be heading to the polls Tuesday, November 8th. Now, earlier we talked about the Safe Harbor Amendment, which is statewide, and there are some other proposed constitutional amendments as well. But we're now going to focus on Fulton County, and joining us in the studio is County Commission Chairman John Eaves. Welcome, as always.
Thank you so much, Rose and Jim. Happy to be with you once again.
Let's begin with what's taking place in Fulton County and other counties, because they have on the ballot, there's a MARTA sales tax and a tax referendum and additional sales tax of a half penny and all this stuff. And someone says to me, I feel like I'm always voting to expand MARTA. What's up?
Well, I mean, there's quite a bit of attention, of course, with the presidential elections, but a lot of the local initiatives, the referendum that are on the ballot are very important. So if you're a City of Atlanta resident, you have before you a half a penny additional revenue source for MARTA expansion that will potentially expand MARTA to the Clifton Corridor, which will be very exciting, a major employment center connecting to Emory University as a higher educational institution, as well as the CDC. So it is a really good opportunity for City of Atlanta residents.
And someone listening may say, okay, we've been down this road before. We know that on statewide, this thing failed miserably in 2012. This is probably the best way for each county just to sort of also determine what their needs are and let their voters, their residents, determine.
Exactly. So, Rose and Jim, not only do you have the MARTA, a half a penny, but you also have a T-SPLUS. This is a transportation tax for City of Atlanta residents and Fulton County residents. And so in terms of the Fulton County resident part, you have the potential of a three-quarters of a penny if you're in North Fulton or South Fulton voting for that referendum that will potentially generate $570 million over the course of the next 5 years. So this is exclusively for transportation infrastructure projects in North Fulton and South Fulton. So these are the cities of North Fulton and the cities of South Fulton and the unincorporated area. And the City of Atlanta also has a T-SPLUS at, I think, 0.4% of a penny that will generate about $300 million.
You've been involved in a lot of these talks over the years about transit options expansion. Is this the first time you really feel like perhaps maybe everyone's on the same page as opposed to having North Fulton saying we want this type of MARTA but not this type of MARTA and other regions saying, well, we want this type of MARTA but not this type of MARTA? So in a sense, does everyone has an opportunity now to get just what they need?
Without question. I mean, we have quite a bit of diversity. We have partisanship, the whole nine yards. But despite the differences of opinion we have as a person come together in terms of recognizing the benefit of not only transportation infrastructure needs for the whole county. You're talking about highways, you're talking about roads, you're talking about bridges, you're talking about sidewalks, you're talking about bike paths, but also the reality that transit is part of the equation to address our traffic and congestion woes. And so you see a great deal of openness in North Fulton, which may have been historically hesitant about MARTA or transit, but now you certainly see an openness and a
recognition. Hesitant's a good word.
It is. I mean, and it's a fair word. But I think that if you look over the 20, 30, 40-year history, it certainly is trending in a very, very positive way. And I've met with the mayors and of North Fulton and residents, and they certainly see that MARTA is an answer, a solution to not just congestion, but also economic development.
At the end of the day, we're asking taxpayers to self-tax.
Yes.
And we're doing so based on kind of arbitrary city lines versus county lines. It can get very confusing. So if everything passes, if all the SPLOST and MARTA, if everything passes, kind of give us an overview of what I might pay for a dollar can of Coke.
Yeah.
What will my tax rate, sales tax rate, look like?
So, I mean, you're talking about 9 cents or 8 cents, you know, and so the thing I think our residents need to understand is that the burden of this revenue source is not solely on Fulton County residents. So you have an individual driving from Detroit down to Florida and stops in Sandy Springs or stops in Union City and purchases something, that individual is contributing towards the revenue. And so it's a burden, or I won't even say a burden, it's a responsibility that's being shouldered by folks who are coming through. It can also be the individual who's coming here for a convention, who goes to a restaurant or goes to buy something at one of our local malls. That individual is also contributing to it. So to me, this is the more important story is close to $1 billion worth of projects could be funded that will support and benefit all of us. And so, yes, it's an additional half a cent or a three-quarters of a cent here and there that will also be contributed by others. But the big prize is tremendous improvement on job creation, infrastructure improvement, economic development. The whole nine yards is going to be a benefit to all of us as a county.
If it does not pass, what does our future as far as transportation look like?
It's another step back. You know, so you all referenced a few minutes ago to, you know, this is not the first time that we've tried this. So I think in 2012, we mm-hmm. tried it. It was a regional effort. I'm more optimistic, and we've worked hard. There is almost uniform support across jurisdictions within the county in terms of political leadership who see that this is a good thing. And the feedback we're getting from our constituents so far has been very, very positive. So I'm very optimistic.
The voice you hear is Fulton County Commission Chairman John Eaves. And I want to move to this measure, and that's the Fulton County Freeport exemption of e-commerce. Now, folks are going to see this on the ballot. And I think I can say, I don't speak for all of Atlanta. They probably don't want me to do that. But many will have zero idea what this means. Let's start with the basics. What problem does this promise to solve? So, what y'all doing over there in Fulton County with this?
So the short of it is, you know, e-commerce is now the wave of the future. Going to Sears and JCPenney's is sort of the past, you know.
And now, wait a minute now. Some folks may like going to Sears and JCPenney, but continue.
Is that where you got your pretty sweater from?
Continue, sir. Man, a sweater, man.
And so,
classic sweater.
So we're talking about an exemption on a tax of inventoried goods that are in these warehouses on within the unincorporated part of Fulton County. And so it's designed to be an incentive to attract the Googles and the Amazons, et cetera, of the world to come here and to provide jobs and to have their have their goods here at an exempted price. And so on the front end, there's an exemption. On the back end, we're all going to benefit because of what we will receive from these companies.
All right. So these companies are already paying this excise tax, right? If I have a warehouse, I'm housing e-commerce goods, whatever it is, if I'm Amazon, Google, Dick's Sporting Goods, whoever, I'm paying a tax to Fulton County for this.
So it's the goods that are being held that have not necessarily been sold. So mm-hmm. we're exempting the held goods. Now the sold goods are subjected to a tax, but it's the held goods that are being exempted.
But right now, as we stand, they are not exempt.
They're not exempt, and so this legislation, if it passes, will exempt those goods that are being held, stored, and warehoused in our companies.
Do you know how much revenue is coming into the county from these stored goods?
So, Jim, it's a really good question. I don't know the exact answer, but, I mean, it's fair to say that, you know, a certain percentage of our revenue as a county does come from, you know, the warehouses and the companies that are in many parts of our county. So, but the early assessment that was given to me by those who have been pushing this is that it's really a minimum amount of money that will be lost. But the big prize, as I'm trying to articulate, is that we're attracting big companies. And it's certainly the wave of the future in terms of e-commerce. And so this is sort of an incentive. This is sort of an olive branch. This is sort of a recognition that we need to give up a little bit to gain a lot.
What about competitors surrounding counties? Do they have this type of exemption?
So my understanding is the state gave all of us as counties the opportunity to put forth this type of legislation, but Fulton County is, I believe, one of the first to do it. So I can't speak for our neighbors in terms of counties in the metro Atlanta area, but we certainly are one of the first, and we see that this is a good thing.
Chairman, I want to get your thoughts on this because the Georgia NAACP and the Atlanta chapter are campaigning and encouraging voters to vote no on all of these proposed constitutional amendments. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, listen, in terms of the safe harbor, I think, I'm not sure if it's Amendment 1 or 2, but the 2, I don't agree. I think we should support it. The sex traffic industry in Georgia, in Metro Atlanta, in Fulton County, the city of Atlanta, is one of the worst. And the county is grappling with this issue. We're addressing this issue, but it is overwhelming. And any additional revenue stream that can be captured through penalties or assessments of the sex entertainment industry, which I think is a contributor, is warranted, and it will yield a positive result for our communities.
Any idea as to why they would want people to vote against this? Have you talked to them? Because you're very close with a lot of local leaders.
I think it's an oversight. I just think if people really understood what this was designed for, that they would be supportive of it. So I voted for it, and I'm encouraging others to vote for it as well.
2 weeks, basically, until the election. What are you going to be doing to kind of promote knowledge about these specific things on Fulton County's ballot?
So, Jim, great question. The first thing is we're very excited as a county in terms of the level of voter participation so far. We've had over 80,000 people do early voting since last Monday. This compares with Gwinnett that has 13,000 and DeKalb that has about 44,000. So we are leaps and bounds ahead of everybody. So the good news is people are participating. We also think that it's important for us to inform the public. So we have, as a county, certainly provided information about the T-SPLOS and the Freeport exemption legislation. Our county can't use public dollars to advocate one way or the other, but we certainly have put information out there. But as an individual, I certainly can encourage people to vote one way or the other. And so we're doing our part in terms of access, accessibility, 24 early voting sites. It's just a matter of people trying to do what they can to become educated about what's on the ballot.
Fulton County Chairman John Eaves, as always, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Jim and Rose, thank you as always.
Talking about my sweater, man. It's a classic. What you talking about?
That's it for today's show. We're going to end on that note. Closer Look is produced by Candace Wheeler and Ebony Lemon. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is coming up next. This is member-supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta. It's 2 o'clock.